Legitimate, oversight.
Last night was the first night?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's bring the meeting to order. We're here discussing House Bill 596, permanent fund. Commissioner Gallagher's here along with Mr. Denzel, or at least Mr. Denzel's not called someplace.
He's over in his talking to the Senate.
Oh, I see. All right. And at this point, Commissioner Gallagher, we'd like for you to go ahead and proceed with the suggested amendments and discussion of same.
Two items on the agenda this morning. One was the permanent fund, continuation of the permanent fund. The other was House Concurrent Resolution 109 by the Finance Committee. That was the one that was reported out the other day on annulling the regulations on highways maintenance. And if, I'd like to get that one out of the way first. Is there any objection to it?
I'll move to report it out.
Is there objection?
Is that the resolution?
It's a permanent fund.
What's the name
of the objection? So all right, we will continue where we left off the other day. Mr. Gallagher, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After I read the newspaper clippings the other day, I thought that it almost read like I didn't think there was some redeeming features about the bill. That's not true. I think that the workable bill. It has some intent behind it, it's wrong, there are just a few amendments that need to clear it up, make it more efficient. But I think some of the other positive aspects about the bill, the bill does include an Alaska Enterprise Investment Fund. And I guess where we would like to put more emphasis is on the positive nature of that fund. We'd like to see that fund expanded to reflect at least 50% of the receipts of the permit fund going into that agency. That's one agency that can look at the development in Alaska and make some positive contribution. It's split into two halves. One half goes into private enterprise development. It only does that after it surveys the economy and finds out where there are good opportunities to invest. I think one of the logical results of that analysis will be the 200-mile limit. Also, on the other half of that fund, it looks at community development. One of the obvious places for the state needs money in this is in utilities. And I think that is an obvious conclusion in the bill. I think we had a pretty heavy debate on the merits at the last meeting about the merits of increasing it. So I'd like to move on. And that covers the first three of the amendments. The fourth amendment is the amendment that I passed out to you. Says that the permit shock fund should be preserved for the future generations of Alaska. We just like to say that some benefits should be available to present generations. And it's a minor item. The fifth amendment we'd like to see is that Commissioner of Revenue should be made a non-voting member of the Board of Trustees. The reason for this amendment is the Commissioner of Revenue is the state's financial officer. These are state funds. He should have some input and should be a party to those transactions. Amendment number six that we'd like to see adopted is that we'd like to see that the Board of Trustees, or the quorum for the Board of Trustees, increase from two members to three members. We wouldn't like to see just two members of the public vote the whole change in direction of the permanent fund. And this is possible under the way the bill is drafted. Since it's such a small committee of only three trustees, we think all three members need to be there in order to make sure that proper direction is given to the fund. The seventh amendment deals with the policy issue whether the Department of Revenue should be the management staff to the Trust Fund Corporation. As you have the bill drafted, this bill will require at least five to six people full time on duty. If the Department of Revenue were to operate this fund, I can't imagine adding more than one person, because already the infrastructure is in place, the accounting records are set up. It's just a whole lot more efficient. You could save probably $280,000 a year in salaries. Not only that, the Department of Revenue is already administering funds of this size. The original reason that the Department of Revenue supported going outside the Department of Revenue was to give it visibility. But now that it's a trust fund, and that was visibility when it was a development function, which took more public scrutiny than a trust fund. A trust fund is a very quiet operation. We just don't see the need for all independent public visibility.
Mr. Green.
Yeah, Sterling, that's an interesting thought. However, in recent history, there's been some scandals involving trust funds. And I think the, as you point out, the original bill that came down from the governor under the advice of the State Investment Advisory Committee did recommend a separation and emphasize visibility. And I, just because it's called a trust fund doesn't mean it should be less visible. I would think that the reverse would be true and it should be more visible. The public would want to see something very, very visible and probably separate from the management of the general fund, which is the money, of course, that we appropriate and use for any purpose the legislature sees fit. And I think there's maybe a reason inherent in the constitutional amendment for a separation of those, as well as as much visibility as any development bank.
Well, we'll have a fund that's equal to this size, that's a trust fund already in the books, and it's of course the public employees, pension funds. Yet there's no big hue and cry. The point is that the way the bill is structured, it probably only takes one investment officer to operate the fund. We don't see the need to set up a secretary, executive director, and all these other functions just so one man can do the work. What price? No visibility. At $200,000, for salaries, you can put on a lot of campaigns, advertising, that sort of thing.
Go ahead, Mr. Gallagher.
The Amendment 8 is a tiny technical amendment. But the way the prudent man rule now reads in the bill is the prudent man rule applies even to personnel policies. I'm not aware of a prudent man rule applying to personnel policies. It says the prudent man rule applies to the management of the corporation. And the prudent man rule only applies to investments. There are a lot of things that the prudent man rule, there's no concept in law that it applies to other than investments, and it has all to do with the management of the corporation. So we'd like to see the prudent man rule restricted just to what you do by managing investments. Amendment 9 is a curious it tries to clarify the reasonable diversification clause in the bill. And let me read you the bill on the point. Shall seek to maintain a reasonable diversification.
Mr. Would you give us the page and
yes.
Line on that?
Page 10, line 6.
Thank you.
The board shall seek to maintain a reasonable diversification among corporate investments, unless under the circumstances clearly improved not to do so. I think the policy should be you should keep a reasonable diversification. There's no need to be redundant about it. Put a period after keep a reasonable diversification on corporate investments. That's the policy of the board. Because the last half of the sentence has to do with the word reasonable. But it clearly isn't reasonable and it's imprudent.
Mr. Green.
So that I understand this, you're not objecting to the language here, you just say it's redundant.
That's right.
I mean, to the intent of it. Okay.
Amendment 10 prohibits the corporation with working with current existing state agencies and departments. We think it's clearly desirable that the permanent fund cooperate and coordinate its activities with other state agencies. If there's Amendment 10, Clark, is page 10, line 13.
Okay.
And I'll read you the line. The board may enter into and enforce contracts necessary to the purpose of this corporation, except it may not contract with agencies or departments of the state to recommend or select investments. If there's something that there's a specialty that one of the state departments know about, I think it's really prudent that they should look into something like that. Amendment number 11 that we would recommend would replace the gains and loss section and replace it with a reserve section. I think what the author intended was the securities gains and loss provision. But clearly, that isn't the only thing that should be made. We should protect ourselves against. This bill allows us to invest in loans. We feel that there should be a reserve for bad debts in case one of loans ever goes bad. Also, there are such things as Penn Centrals. The whole idea behind reserve clause is to keep the permanent fund permanent and not let any of its assets be allowed to be dissipated through lossage. And of course, how you maintain a reserve account is through keeping some of the income back and make sure that the permanent fund stays permanent. That way everyone understands whether the loss record of the permanent fund also. The 12th Amendment is, I'm very surprised it's in the bill. It's kind of a moving average of current investments. And that's how you track income. I think it's entirely proper that you should know what the investments are or income you made each and every year. How it was handled in the governor's bill was that you had an annual audit. And by certified financial or certified public accountants, and when they came up with a certified annual statement, this was your statement, I think. And they also would look at the reserve for loan losses at the same time. That would give the legislature a better idea of whether this agency was making money or not. The way it is with the income provision and the gains and loss provisions, they average your income. If you have a large loss, it really doesn't show up for 5 years. I think everyone should know about it right up front.
The next section, or actually two sections on the next page, deals with the same provision you just referred to as being in the prior bill. It provides for an annual post audit and a report by an audit, an independent auditor. So, problems hopefully will show up then.
Well,
that would include looking at all calculations. It goes behind the state, any audit would.
I agree with that, Clark. But the financial statement averages the income. If you had a disastrous year, let's say, and you're allowed to go in the stock market, you're allowed to average your losses over 5 years. I think they should show up immediately. Take your loans when they can. If you got a great year, allowed to be showing. I don't think you should sit there and average.
How, speaking of that, how you mentioned the fact that
Revenue manages these funds, trust funds presently. How do you do it? Are there any regulations that you've established to?
We take them all current.
Is this by regulation or just a decision that you've made?
Management practice.
But it isn't in writing?
No, I don't believe it is.
Mr. Meekins?
Sterling, in addition to the need to have whatever the losses is, might be when you're on the upfront program rather than average, the part that I'm interested in here says the income available for disbursement shall be determined on an annual basis.
Well,
what do you think?
I think that's just part of my point. If you're making progress, you want to show the actual performance of the fund, not 5-year moving average of how it's performing.
Well, does that mean that if 4 years I have a great amount of a great return, and then the fifth year I have a loss, but the average is still positive, that means that I have money for, that means that I can disperse some of that income, but I don't make any income up here?
Yeah. And conversely, yeah. Even though you had three good years and one disastrous year that overwhelmed anything, for four of those years you probably could put money out in the fifth year, and for the next 5 years you couldn't put money out. So you had 4 good years after that. So that's why I think the reserve for bad debts and current taking of gains and losses is a more accurate way to show the books.
You know, I think on the what you call the converse is might be fairly prudent in the sense that if you had say the first year of the 5 years, the first 2 years you had tremendous losses, then you had 3 years where you had fairly good years, but you might want to average them so that you didn't think that even though, you know, the current year you have a good return, but you might want to sort of make up for the losses that you had incurred previously. So in that sense, I could see where averaging might be a relatively prudent thing to do. But when it works the other way, when you've had losses, and then
the reserve for bad debts keeps the money, if you're having losses, it keeps the money, keeps the permanent fund whole during that time period. So you have charge off. If you have a security gain loss, you take it immediately. But let's say you have a loan loss, or you look like you have a Penn Central on your book, it will immediately set up at the end of the year a reserve for that amount, and so the money will not go out of the fund.
And do you replace the money in the reserve account next year if you've got revenue?
Yes.
You take it. That's the first thing you do.
Right. If at the end of the year the accountants will come along and they'll take, you know, let's say what I call a picture, but they'll look at the assets, examine them, to see if they're in sound condition, and they'll say, we have $200,000 of losses in your fund, therefore keep $200,000 out of the income in the reserve account. All the rest of it can go out. Now let's say you get a big Penn Central, you have $2 million in Penn Central. You come along, cut back your income by $2 million, and put out the rest, reserve it. And let's say later Penn Central starts to pay out, like their Waldorf Astoria, they sell it, get a big cash gain, get some advance in that. Then, at that point in time, you reduce your reserve.
Okay. Well, I can see where you need to. For reporting purposes, you need the information on a yearly basis how you're doing. And secondly, I can sort of see maybe there's a problem with saying the amount of income available for disbursement is determined by averaging on a 5-year basis. But don't you need, on the other hand, don't you need sort of a longer run picture when you're trying to make good decisions as well as just what's happening that 1 year? I mean, you wouldn't want to make decisions on how much money to disperse just based on 1 year, because it might be some sort of
your reserve for bad debts will always tell you whether you had right at that point in time.
What will it tell you?
You had losses.
Well, I know, but even if you're say relatively in the money, I mean, you're making some sort of like 3 or 4 or 5% return. Then 1 year you make 15% return. I mean, according to, if you did it on a yearly basis, that would mean you would spend all that 15% that year. But it seems to me that a person ought to look at a longer range rather than just 1 year might not. I mean, that's what I think you might lose if change it to yearly. Do you have any way of maintaining that long view?
I think there's a way to maintain the long view is maybe make a combination of the two and have a security gains and losses account that you average over 5 years. We also have a reserve for bad debts because even securities go bad.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Frame, could we touch once more on that reserve? I didn't go back and check it against the bill, but is your suggestion there, does that apply to the permanent fund and the AEIC, or just...
It applies to both of them.
Well, the question that comes to my mind, and maybe I'm looking at this wrong, it seems to me reserves are, in effect, immobilized money, isn't it? I mean, I can see reserves when you're trying to protect somebody else, but we have state, we're talking about state money in both instances, are we not, as far as...
Well, the reserve account is the only way. A reserve account is a liability side of the balance sheet account. Of course, you got the money left invested on the asset side of the balance sheet. You're earning money off of it. You don't stick over there on the left-hand side of the balance sheet and put it in a checking account waiting for it to go bad. But the reserve account is an accounting device to tell you that you have some bad assets in your accounts, on your books, and tells you, here's your problem areas. That's how a reserve account is created.
I would hope that as far as the permanent fund itself is concerned, that we're not going to have any bad debts.
Well,
I would almost go for an amendment that when you have bad debts in the permanent fund, you take the board out and shoot them.
At sunrise.
Including the ex officio officer.
You're Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Swanson.
This was the question I was going to direct to the chairman of the permanent fund committee. Where in the world did you leave a loophole that big to run Penn State Railroad through it?
There isn't.
Thank God.
That was Sterling's suggestion. Sterling, I have a call. What is your bad debt account? Have you set up a bad debt account, so to speak, in the pension funds?
No, but we should have one. I agree. You have to set one up in the liability side of the balance sheet.
Well,
I agree that there should be one there.
This is one of the reasons I think that maybe a separate investment function, separate from, say, your department, might be useful, because I think they may engage in some investment practices that would serve as a good example and you might adopt. In other words, these suggestions may or may not be good, but one of the reluctances we had, and this was on the advice of Mr. Robert Blix, who is separate from, say, the commissioners in Minnesota, suggested that it do have a visibility and that it adopt the written investment practices. And one of the practices the trustees could adopt would be this reserve account, if it were a good idea. But hopefully they would set up some written rules and regulations so that these things are clearly set out.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out to you that I'm the one that's making the recommendation. It wasn't some other outside party, so I don't know how that reflects on the Department of Revenue. But other than that, if you don't have it set up statutorily, there's no authorization to do it. You can't go out and write regulations and come up with policies if there's no statutory authority to do it. So what I'm recommending is you give statutory authority to do it.
I believe we ought to allow the trustees would set out policy.
But
they do it in writing.
But this affects the county, which is something that's mandated by legislation. There's no authority. You can't do it.
What?
We can have all sorts of good ideas over in the administration, but you can't get bills passed to implement them. So what?
Why can't the State Investment Advisory just recommend some written procedures and have them adopted? You can promulgate regulations, can't you? Well, through regulations, I think, established.
Maybe one of the points, Clark, is I've got a bill over here. It's been over here for a year and a half. I don't know whether it's in this committee or that committee, but it saves only $80,000 a year, so no one's interested in it. It's not a big headliner bill, but it's one that says, you know, when you're keeping, you can keep your reserves when you compensate banks in savings accounts or time deposits instead of checking accounts where the reserve accrues.
We passed that out.
It's over in the Senate.
Unanimously, right?
Yeah. But the point is, Clark, you need statutory authority to change administrative practice.
Okay. On the reserve account, the way that this amendment's written, it would indicate that they could reserve any amount of income they chose.
No.
I mean, there doesn't seem to be a limitation.
That's whatever the certified public accountants say they need to reserve to accurately reflect the income that they earn. And that's how, otherwise your permanent fund is not permanent, Clark.
Well, that's the purpose of this bill, is to make it permanent.
Well, and that's why you need a reserve account.
Well, we'll take a look at that. That's
otherwise, you know, you don't have a permanent fund.
Well, you don't have a permanent fund. The reserve account doesn't help you if you're in bad investments. All it does is replace money that's already lost.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and our proposal re-injects the total income back into the fund. I think what you're getting at is a reporting requirement that makes it clear what's happening, where your losses are.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got income under our proposal going back into the fund, so it should.
Well, then when they take the income out of the fund, are you going to put in a reserve account?
Well, not all of it's coming out of the fund. Probably.
Well,
I think the point is that you've got practices that are losing money. And this is one of the reasons this averaging is in here, is so that there isn't a reluctance on the part of the managers to get rid of, say, a bad investment. It's true that even the best managers don't always hit 100%. And that goes for commissioners and others. So the moving average does leave an incentive not to leave it in there, so that they're not showing a loss or carrying, say, bad investments year after year just because they don't want to show a loss.
I agree with I think, Clark, what's best is a combination of the two: security gains and losses, and reserve account for bad debts.
Mr. Meekins?
That's just what I was going to ask. Wouldn't it be better to put them both in, because I can see some benefits to both. I think your point is a pretty good one, Sterling, about it's obviously a trade-off between whether or not you're going to have see it up front, or whether or not you're going to discourage the manager from cutting his losses. But I think you just have to, if you have that kind of a manager, you got to. Those guys are going to have to take the heat, I guess, if there is anything like that. And they're supposed to be prudent enough to get rid of a bad investment when it's a bad investment, even if it makes them look not so good for that year, because you're doing it on a yearly basis. I don't know what the tendency of managers is. Do you think that there'd be a real problem with that we need to give them an incentive by sort of hiding the loss over a five-year period by distributing it on average?
This way, there's no way, if you have a reserve account, there's no way to hide it, because a certified public accountant comes on and looks at the asset and says, manager, you got a loser here, and that's how it comes up.
Okay, and then what does he do when he finds out he's a loser?
Well, you just get rid of it.
Right.
Well, you either write it off or wait until it comes alive again, like Penn Central. I use that as an example. They're now selling the Waldorf Astoria and a few of their other assets and getting cash back to the pay off some of the debts, but.
Sterling, doesn't the fact that it's certified public accountant looks at it, isn't that the element that discovers the bad investment, but not the fact there's a reserve account? I'm not disagreeing with the idea.
I agree with that, but, you know, he's gotta have somewhere to put the money.
You wanna have something to make it up from?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't think there's any problem with that.
But there still remains a question as to whether the income should be averaged or done on yearly.
The security gains and losses, as long as it's, the security gains and losses, I don't have any problems with that, because that, that's fine, as long as it isn't stock gains and losses. If it's bonds gains and losses, that's fine. But if it's stocks, you get to take your losses when you get them. I don't want them to put their stock losses in their 5-year moving average. Well, a bond gain and loss is something that, you know, the market is, quite often you'll do a swap from one security to the other. You may take a loss, but you pick up more income than this other security. And that's why you move from one security to the other.
Mr. Green.
But if you have stock losses, you know, maybe even stock losses are appropriate to move over 5 years, because the stock market is somewhat volatile, as we know.
Okay. Now, we've limited the amount that can be invested in stocks. Now, what's your opinion on that? Should we further limit it or expand it?
I think it's fine. I wouldn't go beyond that 30% as an investment. I don't have that much faith in the stock market.
Well, I don't either. Now, I've forgotten, what's the requirement, 298? Is there a limitation there?
I don't think we even allowed stock.
Yeah, I really was the one to push for that. I don't know that, I understand your point now on that. You're against or you're for the 5-year averaging. Well,
Clark, I guess, you should have both. You should have a reserve for bad debts, and you should average your gains and losses.
Okay.
But both of them are a kind of a reserve. Right.
Sterling, I'm getting confused on the difference between Section 140 and Section 150, the gains and losses in the income section. When you talk about averaging gains and losses, are you referring to the language that's 140?
Let me, what page are
we on? Page 11, line number. Because, see, I'm reading down here on line 24, or actually line 25, which says, the income available for disbursement shall be determined on an averaging basis. And I thought you were remarking against that, saying that we ought not do it on an averaging basis.
Well, the bonds are in stocks. Well, I'm reading this for this first, you know, the fine points. I see securities, and then I also see the word bond in it. So I don't know whether you limited what you've done with stocks in there, because stocks is a security but isn't a bond. So you may have a combination there. But what this is an average account for market losses, not for a reserve for bad debts.
Right.
Okay.
But your amendment would delete this whole section.
No, I think I'd leave this section in.
Okay.
What I would like to see, though, is done for an additional reserve.
Okay.
But then I think I'd drop the income averaging. Because
that's a separate question from this gains and losses.
Right.
I don't understand the distinction. Mm-hmm.
Well, this one says if you earn 6.4% this year and 6.5% next year and 6.6 next year, you only show them 6.4,
wherever they are,
or whatever average is.
Yeah, well, and it also says that the income available for disbursement, I don't know if you're aware, but should be determined on an average basis. And that part doesn't seem right to me. I mean, I'm just wondering if you changed your position, because you convinced me when you were originally saying this wasn't good. Now,
okay.
I thought you changed your mind. I
maybe
I could change your position.
No. There are. You kind of got apples and oranges in here. You got a securities gains and loss provision in here, but you have other things in securities and investments. You have mortgages. When you take the gains and losses out of this provision, which are only for securities, then you combine them and put them into a five-year moving average. Is that what you say?
Okay. The income is all is income on all investments.
Right.
And then it says that the income shall be averaged over 5 years to determine to show what you've got that year. It's really not that year; it's an average of 5 years.
Right.
And secondly, you use that average to determine what you can disperse rather than what you made that 1 year.
Right.
And that doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
I would drop 150. I would put in a reserve clause, and also reserve for bad debts. I would expand the gains and losses for section and turn it into a reserve account. One would be gains and losses for securities, which is a market gain and loss. The other one's a credit risk.
Like on reserve. Would apply to what? Give me an example.
You bought a Penn Central.
Well, you wouldn't do that. Okay. A real example.
You bought a mortgage.
Yeah.
What
so you'd keep in 140, put in a reserve provision in there, and then strike the income.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are we through with that one?
I hope so.
Mr. Gallagher, I think you down to amendment number 13, if I remember right.
I'm not exactly familiar with amendment 13. Let me go on to 14.
All right.
Amendment 14 is going back to it's just like amendments 1, 2, and 3. It increases the income going into the Enterprise Investment Corporation. All the long debate that goes with that. And I don't have to go into the debate to make the point on where amendments 15 and 16 allow when income comes into the permanent fund, it allows it to go directly into the Enterprise Investment Corporation. Amendment 17.
Just Mr. Gallagher, would you do that one more time? 15
and 16 allow the payment of the principal that comes into the permanent fund. Currently, 1/6 of the permanent of the money that comes into the permanent fund goes, I guess it goes directly into the enterprise, permanent fund corporation, and then it goes back up to the enterprise side. I just want to make it direct.
Thank you.
Oh, amendment number 17, this is having to do with the enterprise fund. And there is a whole series of this amendment 17, 18, 20, 21, 22, and 23. All have to do, and 24 have to do with the recommendation that you have one additional commissioner on the policy board.
Is that to drop, you drop a public member and add another government person?
Yes. The point is, the commissioner of revenue is the state's financial officer. He's there to keep a check on making sure the assets are sound. The Commissioner of Commerce is there for the development function that's in this institution. So he should be giving the government policy on that point of view. The Commissioner of Revenue serves as a check against the Commissioner of Commerce, which is a normal a reason why you have two commissioners on there. One to give
different government viewpoint. Typical story of bureaucracy.
Yeah, Mr. Duncan suggested if we didn't have any, we wouldn't need the check.
Can't the governor
is under this proposal is empowered to put one representative in his choice. Can he pick somebody that is the perfect person?
We all have our feet of clay.
Well, you better believe it.
Mr. Rhodes.
And on page
page 14, line 26, didn't it take that into consideration? Well, not necessarily. Just leave it away from pointing anybody wants to.
Yeah.
Kind of had that with us before.
That's the way we resolved that. We got, we're gonna have anybody, executive sitting on it. Didn't want to play any favorites. We got it from the table.
Fishing game on there.
Yeah.
And don't worry, he's gonna be there.
Further questions on that section? Not continue, Mr. Gallagher.
Amendment 19 has to do with having the president of the Enterprise Investment Corporation as chairman of the policy board, but not a voting member. He is the link between the investment committee and the policy committee. He should be on both boards because he is the link that walks, takes the directions from one board to the other board. He's the day-to-day staff. We feel he should be on the board. Amendment 24. Let's read that. Page 15, line 9. This is kind of an amendment that goes along with when you add another public member, but we said that you needed, whenever you had a vote, you also needed a majority vote of the appointed members of the public members. This is keep a check on the power of the commissions. So that, you know, sometimes your voice is louder than life, so it's kind of a...
Mr. Meekin.
So it's a majority of the full membership.
That is currently, but we're saying this, we'd added an additional restriction when you add a second commissioner, that it's a majority of the appointed members, but they're not the commissions.
Mr. Buckle.
Are you saying then here that the members will be doing a voice vote? You were saying the loudest.
No, when I kind of use the innuendo. Quite often when you're on one of these boards and the commissioner speaks, everyone thinks it's governmental policy. And sometimes he's voicing his personal opinion. So we're trying to put some balance to that that fear and making sure that there's the majority of the appointed members make policy decisions.
Further questions on that?
Amendment 25, the Enterprise Fund, we think the best way, currently the budget is approved by the, goes through the Executive Budget Act. We do not feel that this is the, we think that the management is more responsive. If they have to live or die by their own management decisions, we think that they will show a better cost record if they can develop their own budget. But we put a restriction on this so that if they spend over half of 1% of the corporation's asset in doing that, then they have to go before the legislature. So that it puts a real restriction, makes them performance oriented in the fund, because the cost of their operations, under the way we have it written, comes out of the income of the fund.
but we put a restriction on it. It shouldn't be any greater than half of 1% of the assets of the fund. So it makes the managers of the enterprise, investment corporation, performance oriented.
Mr. Meekins.
I just think, you know, there's a trade-off between oversight and accountability to the legislature and the public and the autonomy of the state to make good decisions. And you can sort of jump on either side of this, but my work with the Alaska County Finance Corporation, we don't have their operating budget. They get out of the same way. And it just seems to me you can really have problems with it. Board if you don't have any control over them at all. And I think that I wouldn't imagine that the legislature would be too harsh on the operating expenses of this corporation. I think they'd be, you know, fairly reasonable, but without the accountability that you have, having your operating budget go through the Executive Budget Act, you lose all accountability to the public.
Mr. Green.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what a half of 1% of $2 billion might be in $2 billion.
Works out to
$10 million. $10 million. So you mean to say that they spend $10 million to administer this thing, they're gonna be under the executive budget.
That's why it's in the bureaucracy.
Yeah, well I hope we shut them off before they get to $10 million. That seems absurd.
Mr. Green, I think you better figure out some of your banks take to operate, you'll find out that they take more than half of 1%. So if you think that's ridiculous standard, I think it'll run up more under coming through the legislature.
Of course, this is, you're talking about the enterprise function here, aren't you? Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Well, they're not going to have that kind of asset. I mean, $2 billion, but for the trustee function to spend that kind of money is clearly out of line.
Absolutely. If they spend over a quarter of 1%, I'll be surprised.
But I think Russ's point is well taken. Keep track of what they're doing, to have any kind of, let's say, not legislative or political interference as to how the loans are made, but to at least have an idea of whether the policies that we set out in this statute, in terms of permanence, goals, and standards are followed, we better have, and this goes for the executive too. I mean, I think one of the reasons you're suggesting commissioner involvement, of course, is to give the executive some part in the policy oversight. And I think the Executive Budget Act is far more effective without getting the actual commissioners involved. Now, one of the suggestions that was made earlier is to put legislators on this, and I think the committee resisted that. The better route to go is through the Executive Budget Act. And I think the parallel's there. Rather than putting commissioners on it, I think the proper way to go about is through the Executive Budget Act. But that was part of our debate.
Well, certainly you have the Oversight Committee already oversighting everything they do.
But it's oversight, and it's not in the management aspect.
There's no sanction.
So that's how we feel, you know, the debate. Amendment 26 restates the diversification rule to limit investments, and this is in the enterprise fund, 1% of the resources of the corporation and 5% on the bill.
We made that, wait a minute. We did lift the limit somewhat. We made that one change.
You increased it to $5 million, Clark. The point is, you also get the prudent man rule working here that allows you to go up to 5% of your bill, but the prudent man rule won't let you get there because unless you're amending the prudent man rule. And I really don't think the prudent man rule will allow you to go up and make this large of an investment. So the prudent man rule is a lot closer to the 1% than the 5%. So I'm restating the kind of the reasonable diversification rule in terms of a percentage of assets, which is normally taken. You're worried about the protection of the fund here, and that's how we handle it.
Mr. Chairman, Sterling, what happens then if 1% of the corporation's resources is really far beyond 5 million?
Well, right now it's only 100 million, so 1% is less than $1 million.
Yeah, right, but if it goes up, then which is better, to designate a figure or to just or to go to your suggestion?
It's better as a percentage, because what you're worried about is the reasonable diversification of the fund, and not whether, and one of the prime examples might be the 200-mile limit. Maybe one of the processing plants may take a loan larger than $5 million in order to assist it. If you're limited there to only $5 million, that's all you can do. But let's say the fund is 1980, and or let's say it's 85, and they have allowed the Enterprise Investment Corporation to go up to $700 million, then you can make it a $7 million loan. But we think the 1% diversification rule goes as to relates to the size of the fund. We think with true demand rule already in the fund that you're probably already restricted to 1% anyway. So the $5 million loan limit is maybe violating the true demand rule. And we want you to be aware, if that's what you wanted to do, is violate the true demand rule, then it's an allowable investment.
Mr. Swanson, are you?
No,
sorry.
I was going to say, but you're talking about full funding of the example that you mentioned. It's full funding. Are the investments, is it the intention of this permanent fund to give full funding to any investments?
No.
I was thinking maybe it wouldn't be that way.
What I'm saying is it allows them to go up to that level if they make a certain range. We're saying I and the pension funds run a 1% rule. And the national standards for pension funds are 3%. I think those are too liberal. The standards for commercial banks are about 3/4 of 1%, approximately. The standards for savings loans are, again, about 0.5 of 1%. Your standard is very liberal in comparison to other national standards.
Mr. Swanson, maybe.
Yeah, I had a question that probably was remarked by Mr. Gallagher to Mr. Greening. What in the bill, what protection we've got of investing our permanent funds in a non-renewable resource? Now, by his remarks, I surmise that he meant a petrochemical processing plant or an oil processing plant, which is a non-renewable resource. What protection have we got in the bill to prevent investing our monies in non-renewable resources?
I think the example he's referring to is a fish processing plant.
That's right. I said the 200-mile limit.
Okay.
Mr. Meekin.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterling, when you talk about the fish processing plant, it's $20 million. Are you thinking that the fund would, I mean, I understood from your previous remarks that you wanted to increase the enterprise development fund so that it might get into it.
I agree, but the crude demand rule already impinges on, won't ever allow you to go. I'm probably restating the prudent demand rule and what.
Well, I'm just trying to get a contradiction between trying to increase it so that it can make a $20 million loan and then limiting it to 1% of capital, which would mean you'd have to have $2 billion.
But you're already limited there. I'm saying you're already limited. Don't fool yourself. The prudent demand rule already limits you probably close to 1%.
Well, I understand that, but what I'm pointing, I understand your point, but it gets back to the question of whether or not we should increase the fund. If the prudent demand rule limits you so severely, even if we increased it, we wouldn't be able to do anything about that.
That's not a fact, a legal fact. I hope we can drag that out anymore. The rule applies to the investment, the particular investment being made.
That's right.
Now, 1% of, let's say, $10 billion, if it's made imprudently, is a bigger loss than 5% of $100 million. So what we're getting at here is making prudent investments in the first place. I'm not so worried about the 1% or 5% there. It's just limiting the amount in any one project.
Well, we agreed to that.
See, with your 200 miles, for example.
Clark, no investment officer in his right mind is going to make it a bad investment going into it. They only turn bad afterwards. And we're limiting that exposure to the fund.
Okay, but the example we've been using now is the 200 mile limit. If I understand the amount of money you're talking about to invest in that, it's not, no matter what size we make, if we limit it to 1% here, we're not going to be able to live within that. Even no matter what size we ultimately decide to put this enterprise.
You also have a reasonable diversification requirement. Also goes talks about your particular, and that means a particular size of investment. Clark, you've already limited yourself by putting those words in there. If you want to take those words out, then you can go there. But clearly, 5% would probably violate all national standards.
Mr. Meegan?
But Sterling, let's assume you're right, but you can't argue on both sides of the issue. On the one hand, you're telling us that we need to change this so we can get to the 20 million. On the other hand, you're saying that you're advocating for 1% so we can't get there. So, I mean,
there are also reasonable diversification as to how many dollars you should put in any one industry. If you increase the fund, you have a whole lot more $1 million loans than you can in $100 million loan with $5 million. If you only make one deal there, you still probably only put maybe 20% of the assets in that one industry.
Well, whether we stick with the $100 million in capital, whether we go to 50%, we still wouldn't be able, in your view of things, to finance a $20 million or $40 million fish pond.
You can only aid it in a very peripheral manner. And I made that point the other day.
Okay, that's what I... That's, yeah.
But, again, you can only do things that are reasonable on when you're managing the fund.
All right. We're through with that one?
Yes.
One half of the fund has to do with community enterprise or community development. Part of community development is aiding cities. And one part of the fund, you want to, you ask us not to make any subsidy loans. The best way to help municipalities is to guarantee municipal bonds. That way, that gets them into the municipal market. The state isn't subsidizing that interest rate, yet the state's helping them. We think the guarantee authority should be attached to the Enterprise Development Fund. Because it's a direction of the income, a guarantee in many respects is a direction of the income, we think the legislature should approve of those guarantees. And also, this sets up a reserve account. But if you leave out the guarantee function off the enterprise fund, you pretty well constricted them aiding communities. We feel quite strongly that there should be a guarantee function that goes with the enterprise fund.
Mr. Chairman, we want to make it flexible enough to, of course, to help the communities, but one of the things we had to look at were existing institutions. Now, the bond bank now is already doing that. In addition, there's a proposal in to expand its authority to go into revenue bonding for communities. And I'm just wondering whether, I know the Senate's got a proposal to do away with all these other entities. Is that what you're saying? We ought to do away with them and replace it with this? Or
well, the municipal bond bank is traditionally a general obligation sort of device. We've looked at that the revenue issue part of the municipal bond bank, and we went and talked about the Sitka project to White Weld. White Weld says,
in the hydroelectric?
Yeah. White Weld has said that it probably, even with the municipal bond bank guarantee with that 10% that project would not make it in the financial market. If it would make it, it would make it close to the 8% route, it would pay a high premium. It is only with the guarantee power of some enterprise fund would it make it in the marketplace. And that was my suspicion all along on when you put revenue issues in there. It helps it on the very major communities, but let's say on some of the more minor communities, let's say like Sitka, when you get a very large project, then it isn't of assistance. And that's why when you use the guarantee function, we also think it should come before the legislature for approval.
That's what 595 does.
595 puts the guarantee function over the power authority. I think that's a little bit like, you know, the boxing with the chickens. Here is authority that's mandated to earn a rate of return, and it is mandated is rated on their performance and getting a return. Power authority is not rated that way. But the guarantee function is over the power authority, and they're only out to guarantee hydroelectric projects. There's no check on them. Their mandate is just work on power. If the guarantee function is over here, the mandate is still on the enterprise corporation to look at their bottom line.
Yeah. Well, 595 is here now. Oh. We just pointed out that the power to guarantee is contained in the powers of the corporation on page 18.
I guess I missed it.
Yeah, I did too. Line 20. That's a committee substitute.
Okay, I guess it should be expanded then, Clark, for legislative approval of guarantees.
Right now, if the guarantees are over just 5 million, it requires it.
I really think, Clark, that a guarantee is a direction of income. Under the recent constitutional amendment, you need a legislative approval of that.
Okay. We're almost through these.
Not fast enough to be out of here in 5 minutes.
No, hoping. No.
Okay, Amendment 28 prohibits the corporation from investing or participating with other corporations, let's say a bank, when they get a greater than 2% delinquency in their loans. It says, okay, X bank, you've now got over 2% of your loans with us. They're over 90 days delinquent. Therefore, we can't do any new projects with you until you clean up your act.
Mike, strong is it? Is the loan all the loans that say the bank's making, or just the loans that the fund might have purchased?
The loans that the fund might have purchased. And that particular institution. It's a way of.
Is that a common kind of?
Yes. We do that with our friends.
Commissioner, I believe that's in the existing statute to be determined.
I believe it is too. Amendment 30. It's just a clean up the language. It says render a detailed report, which shall instead of material. Your report only talks about investments. Your report should talk about all the main activities.
It's hard to determine what the owner means.
Not only that. It's misplaced money.
And Amendment 32 again is increase the investments in the enterprise fund. And then Amendment 33 has to do with the transition from the Department of Revenue over to the the permanent fund. How you handle the transition? right now we have contracts that require 30 days notice to the people before we pull accounts out of them.
That's from what you're...
Go ahead.
That's from what you're...
Currently
originally,
yes.
You need 30 days to transfer it.
Okay, Leo Rowe.
Amendment 32, where is that from, Bill? What page?
It's the last page.
Leo, this amendment
back
is somewhere like
11 or 20. Mr. Drain.
Sterling, I think it's a good point. Is would it be possible for the commission to work out with the Permanent Fund Corporation a request for transfer that's within reasonable?
I think just a one-liner. The Permanent Fund Corporation shall work out the transfer.
John, you originally pointed out the need for the provision anyway, and I think we'll take it.
It's Jim.
This
section speaks to the transfer of all funds of the permanent fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. This is speaking to the absolute dissolution of Alaska Permanent Fund then?
No, Mr. Guy, we currently have the investments invested in the by the Treasury. This will move them. This will move them now from our management to the permanent fund management. And this just handles the transition.
Mr. Chairman, but we've been working to establish this Alaska Permanent Fund, but this language speaks to transferring of all funds.
All funds of the permanent fund. We currently have the permanent fund under our Department of Revenue Management. This transfers all funds of the permanent fund to the Permanent Fund Corporation, to another legal entity.
Mr. Rowe.
I might clarify, how many investments are, diversified investments are now made in the permanent fund? More than one investment in it.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Transfer them all.
Okay. That's the end of my... Oh, there are two other comments that I found in reading the bill. They're my personal comments that have not been checked by anyone.
Well, let's hear your unchecked comments.
Y'all are unchecked.
Over on the investments in section G, you read, the board may invest in corporation assets and obligations of the United States, or obligations for which the full faith and credit of the United States are pledged to payment of principal interest. There are certain government agencies where the pledge of the government, full faith and credit, is not behind it, like Federal Home Loan Bank, Fannie Mae, that usually yield 20 or 30 basis points. In other words, state government, U.S. government agencies are not covered here. Also, another small problem is there's no short-term vehicle that it's allowed. Treasury bills usually are on a two-day delay purchase. There should be some sort of investment you can make for a one- or two-day period that so you can earn money when the money is transferred coming in, so you get it placed. But the way this reads currently, there's no eligible investments that are very short-term oriented. Let's say repurchase agreements, certificates of deposit, negotiable certificates of deposits, commercial paper, and that sort of thing. Commercial paper may be allowed, but that's a 30-day instrument. There's nothing allowed for a two-day. There's no savings account or anything like that.
Is Fannie Mae and aren't they obligations considered their paper considered obligations of the United States?
No.
It says obligations or of the United States or obligations to which the full faith and credit.
They're not obligations.
What are they guaranteed by then?
Nothing.
They're a mortgage association.
They're guaranteed by all those mortgages that are behind them.
Are the mortgages guaranteed by?
No. But it's a United States government agency.
It winds up being just whatever collateral was there to start
with. Taxpayer.
Yeah.
There's kind of a moral obligation there for the United States in the middle.
So what's your suggestion?
That you expand the language to government and or its agencies. And also to allow negotiable certificates of deposit and repurchase agreements. That way you got some short-term investments you can make.
Have you done any repurchase?
Oh, we do them all the time.
In this firm?
Oh, yeah. It comes in on one day. You've got to do something with it. You can't wait around for 3 or 4 days and leave it in the checking account. The other point is, my staff is going to have a run on, believe me, you've got all these people in the enterprise will find working at range 30, and my people do the same work for range 22 to range 24, so I'm a little bit worried about a run on my my staff. We think you can get away with a whole lot of this.
We are too.
Let's change that.
I wish you'd be range 21.
No, I'm just kidding.
We've got to be down in 2 minutes. I just have one comment, and Mr. Denzo's here. The other day, a comment was made, I think it was it said, a reasonable, prudent board of trustees will realize investments in Alaska are not prudent. Does that mean that we should change this to make imprudent investments in Alaska? I mean, I'd like to have some explanation.
You're referring to the article in the newspaper, and with all due respect to the reporters in the room, that was taken out of context and misquoted.
Well, that's the way I understood your comments, so maybe...
Possibly then the reporters ought to have checked with me and not with you. However, on the prudent man rule of investments, I stated, with the prudent man rule of investments as you have it written, with the findings that you have under, that begin on page 6, those three separate qualifiers on the purpose and investments of the funds and the goals, and subsequently with the trust law that has been established through the federal courts over, and as the chairman pointed out, a period of several hundred years, we believe that this mandates such a conservative portfolio that you will not be making investments in Alaska because the risk level in those investments are higher than allowed within your own bill and within the trust laws that have been developed over a long period of years.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if there's a problem with the word trustees, if I thought there were, I think we could call them commissioners. That's a problem. We did have an opinion from the leading trust law firm in the United States, which I asked you to respond to, saying that that language did not do anything to the prudent man rule. In other words, the standards are set by the prudent man rule and what other investment standards we have in here. The fact that we call them trustees isn't going to prevent their investment in Alaska if it's prudent to do so. Corey, if I see any legal authority that is binding on Alaska that makes some sense, and the word calling them trustees is a problem, let's call them commissioners. Whatever it takes, but I haven't seen any authority of any kind indicating that would revise a prudent would affect the prudent man rule in a way that would prevent prudent investments in Alaska.
I think it's also in order to remark that people have a notion that the federal courts get to come in and take over any time they want to. They don't. They've got no jurisdiction to rule on any trust established in the state of Alaska. They've got very narrow jurisdictional lines, and that's not within it. So whatever the federal court's done in other states really is not germane to what we're talking about here. What's the commission?
I got one other point I'd like to point out to you, and this is kind of off-the-wall sort of one. 3713-170 audits. Investment Oversight Committee shall provide for the annual audit. Quite often, it's the management agency that's in charge of it, does the audit, then they report to the Oversight Committee. I think that's where the proper management responsibility lies for performing an audit, not in performance audits. Otherwise, the Investment Oversight Committee is in the management business. they should review the documents once they're done. Minor point.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Gallagher.
Thank you.
Just 1 minute.
Okay, Ernie.
I know the time's running out, but I'm related to this survey that was made of capital requirements of the state. And, you know, I don't know if I'm saying the right thing. Everybody can think of everything that they need money for the state to provide help for, but I think there's somewhere along the line we've got to establish some kind of a priority, and I know you guys know what I'm saying. We're talking fisheries and utilities. I think somewhere along that line we've got to establish what the state policy could be. Lots of these things that are in these things, in this so-called wish list, I think those are our local responsibility, and we ought to separate those, you know. Otherwise, in fact, I think it clears the way to identify what the permanent fund really is going to do for all of the people in the state. That's the point I want to make. This technical stuff that's going on here, I think we can work these things out. But I think that the priority objectives ought to be pretty clearly stated, too. I don't say more at the moment.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, we'll adjourn to 1:15.
Good morning, when it's kind of dull, will you? So
that's going to be my special order.
I don't want you making special order speeches when we have lots of work to do. Just do it when it's a dull day.
Okay, let's bring the meeting to order, and what I'd like to do is go back into the community colleges, after which the students have a presentation to make, which includes a film that I understand, I guess that's what this is all about.
Yes.
Okay. And then Juno will make a presentation after that. There is one thing, Pat, that I just got some word on that I'd like to ask you about, if you know about it. Apparently, there's a bid by some outfit called Central Texas or something like that about to do the ABEGD work on an Army basis, I guess at Fort Richardson. And a lot of people, a lot of contractors in the state kind of, apparently their bid came in very low, and a lot of the contractors in the state are very upset about it. And apparently the coordinator at the Eagle River campus has agreed to do these tests on behalf of Central Texas. And I wonder, a lot of people think that perhaps it's not such a desirable thing to do, but I wonder if you knew about this situation, if you had any comments on it.
The coordinator at Eagle River has agreed to the work of Central Texas. I'm not familiar with that part.
Well, it's my understanding that he had agreed to do their testing, their GED testing. I don't know if it's on a contract basis or whether it's just being...
I'd have to check into that specifically with regard to that Central Texas situation. Probably affects both ACC and TVCC. They both lost contracts with the military, TVCC in the Charleston, Reno area. That was a contract that let the Central Texas through June. There'll be an opportunity to rebid that for next year. Central Texas did come in extremely low. There is some feeling that they found out they couldn't quite do it for the price they thought they would be able to do it. So contracts will be rebid again this spring for next year, and both ACC and TVCC will be bidding again. I'll have to specifically check into the river coordinator doing the testing out there.
Of course, an allegation that apparently these things went to bid and then they were canceled, and later the education officer at Fort Richardson juggled the specs around so that it just happened to fit exactly what Central Texas's program was, and the next saying that, oh, sure enough, they got the contract. And I just, you know, wondered about that. I don't know if there's anything, it is a federal matter, really. I just wanted to be sure you...
I know the education officer on the, I guess it was Wainwright, was not happy with having to take the Central Texas operation. Quite well satisfied with what he had in DVC. I'll check into that, though.
Okay, thank you. We were ready to lean on.
We were about ready to start the catch camp, and I had distributed to the committee a sheet that I might take a couple moments to explain.
Please. That would be the long sheet right here. Okay.
I've had requests from various legislators, Richard House Malone, and other individuals for some type of comparative cost per credit hour among the community colleges, and that's what I've attempted to provide you here, based on the statistics in St. Tolesworth's analysis. You might just want to follow along from column to column. The credit hours projected next year under the maintenance budget, the current instructional dollars that are, this would be the instructional dollars under FY79 maintenance. I built in a rural factor, which is based on the actual area differentials that we currently pay to bargaining unit members. In fact, it was money added by the legislature a few years ago. So in order to equate for that, you had to take that out. So that divided into the total instructional dollars, came up with your column four, which would be a revised instructional dollars. The cost per credit hour based on that, then the column six would be a size factor, trying to take into account economies of scale, and using a sliding scale by dividing that into the cost per credit hour, you can come up with an adjusted cost per credit hour, which should allow you to equate somewhat between each unit based on size and geographic factor. On the basis of that, you know, Northwest comes in particularly low, Kenai is rather low, Sitka is rather low.
Dave? Yeah, Pat, I understand the rural factor column is the percentage is built into the community college bargaining contract?
That's correct.
Isn't that only for salaries?
That's only for salaries, right.
But you applied it to the total cost?
Applied it to the total cost. On the basis that if you, you know, you run approximately 82% in personnel in your instructional budget, generally your cost for other items will also be up as high.
Do you have any background material on how you arrived at your size factor of percentages?
No, the size factor would probably be the weakest part of it. Most of it is based on my own experience. Given 25-1 as a suitable ratio in terms of class size to an instructor, smaller units, when they first start, probably wouldn't be able to do any better than 10-1. Therefore, 2.5 factor on that. You could have considered starting at 3 or so for real small units.
My understanding that the community college contract requires a 20-1 ratio statewide on community college teaching loans, not 25-1.
Check the contract, Dave.
It is 20-1.
Shall be 24.
That's maximum enrollment. I think you'll see an average class size statewide is also in the contract. 21.
Yeah, but you also allow up to 100 students per instructor. At four classes per semester would be a 25-1 ratio too. I think you have some things floating back and forth on you there.
I think what you're using is the maximum of what the contract identifies as an average at 21. You're using the maximum in your size factor.
Right.
Seems to me you might have used the average that's called for rather than the maximum.
Yeah. Okay, the anyway, we get a pretty good idea of the adjusted cost as to each one of these centers. Anybody got any questions on these, on this particular handout, Clark?
I still don't understand what the adjusted cost is supposed to show. Is that if you moved Anchorage Community College out to the rural areas, is this what it would cost per credit hour? What does that represent?
The adjusted cost per credit hour?
Yeah.
It takes, allowing for the fact that Anchorage has an area differential of zero, there is no geographic cost there, and allowing for the fact that they're achieving the greatest economy of scale, it equates the other units to ACC, as a, using ACC as a base zero, by taking out the size factor and...
So this is, if you move these colleges to Anchorage, this is theoretically what this, the cost per credit hour would be,
right,
in Anchorage.
If they were achieving economy of scale and didn't have the rural factor.
In other words, if you move Sitka to, let's see, Eagle River to Anchorage, they'd only be paying $28 to...
No, not necessarily. I think
you... Well, I'm trying to understand, I understand it all the way up through column six, but then I get bucked off at the adjusted cost there. I don't know how meaningful that is. I mean, what does it tell us? What's it supposed to tell us?
It'll tell you that if you try to, under your cost per credit hour, on your gross instructional figures that are in your budget at the present time, you'll come up with lots of discrepancies because people are going to talk to you about geographic areas and higher costs to function out there. They're also going to talk to you about the fact that smaller units don't function at the economy of scale that larger units do. So what the adjusted cost per credit hour factor takes into account are both of those items, to say that we're all things equal in terms of geographic area and in terms of size. This is what they are currently budgeted for, and it allows you to see where discrepancies might lie in the cost per credit hour between the units.
Well, does it tell me, that, for example, that Eagle River is a much more efficient operation than Anchorage? Given, I understand the economy, we've always heard ACC, you know, has a, because of the number of students, has an economy of size, but
basically,
try to exclude that. Eagle River is about...
You could interpret it that way, that it is more economical than Anchorage. I think you could add other things to it, that perhaps it is not funded as well, and what services aren't being provided.
In other words, you could look at them with a view towards cutting off the top people, or you could...
Or increasing the lower.
With a view towards unloading a lot of money on the bottom, depends on how you look at it. That in the credit hour column, are any credit hours included in that column that are derived from Fund 2 expenditures? Because I don't think you pointed out that this is a Fund 1 schedule. Is this all general fund?
No. I would imagine that there are some credit hours. It's very difficult to identify from the current structure exactly what, how much could be applied to Fund 2 and how much could be applied to Fund 1.
So it's
this is, the budget figures are Fund 1. Yes. The credit hour production are total.
Okay, because I know, for instance, that the oil companies are funding a couple of courses out of Kenai, which is just one example. So it wouldn't show up in
no.
general fund expenditures. It would show up in, I guess, program expenses. There's also, Mr. Chairman, about over $700,000 in Fund 2 expenses at ACC and instruction. So may have some bearing on the student credit production there.
Some of that, of course, will take into account adult basic education, which normally isn't computed into your credit hour account. And some of it will also be non-credit, other programs that don't necessarily generate credit hours.
Okay, Mr. Duncan,
could the far right of the chart be explained? Perhaps you explained it.
Oh, yes.
It.
No, I didn't. The far right is, I think, much less accurate in any way. What we attempted to, based on the idea that the institutional support, academic support, student services ought to grow concomitantly with the instructional program, we tried to compare the current costs of administration, academic support, student services, and physical plant to the instructional budget. So when you see, for instance, at Kenai Peninsula Community College under institutional support, relative to instruction, it's 55%. So they would have an institutional support budget approximately 55% of their instructional budget. That institutional support is primarily your various administration, business services, and the like. So it would allow you to compare those by percentage between the institutions. Academic support would be your generally library, media services, and the like, and then your student services component. It also identifies those which are not necessarily budgeting for student services at the present time.
So let's take Juneau, for example. What's that mean?
Okay, there's difficulty with three units, ACC, JDCC, and TVCC, from the standpoint that currently all of their institutional support, physical plant, and some of their student services are budgeted under the institutional support, under those categories for UAJ, UAA, and UAF. Basically what it would mean though is under Juneau, 17% of their instructional, if you took 17% of their instructional budget, that's approximately